Welcome to the Healing Theology Podcast, where we explore the intricate connections between religion and public health. I'm your host, Alejandra Salemi, founder of Healing Theology. Each week, we bring you conversations with thought leaders, experts, clergy, researchers, and scientists who are working to bridge the gap between faith and science. Together, we challenge misconceptions, spark meaningful dialogues, and discover how these two worlds can come together to create healthier, more united societies. Thank you for joining us on this journey of season two. Let's dive in. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Healing Theology Podcast. I'm excited to bring back a second part to our mini Oxford series, bringing some incredible humans from Oxford University to share their research with us. And so I'm especially excited to have an accidental, also a two-part series on amazing Columbian scholars, which is also just extra fun for me. I want to introduce you to our guest first before we jump into some conversations around imagination and peace building. Our guest is Dr. Eduardo Gutierrez, who recently finished his doctorate at the University of Oxford with a thesis seeking to contribute to peace building from theological and philosophical reflections. After studying philosophy, a BA and an MA, Eduardo worked in faculties of philosophy and political science in Bogota, Colombia, before doing an MST in science and religion at Oxford. His current research focuses on the role of imagination in belief transformation and explores its potential use for fostering peace and reconciliation in Colombia. He is an Adam Smith Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, a member of Rodeamos el Diálogo, and he has also been appointed Junior Research Fellow in the Humanities and Social Sciences at Blackfriars Hall at Oxford. Dr. Eduardo loves world building in all forms of art, especially in literature, and has a long obsession with the transformative power of dialogue and analogical reasoning. So, Dr. Gutierrez, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Alejandra. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me and having me over.
Yeah, I'm very excited to have this conversation. I want to do a general check-in, even though we did one offline. How are you doing? What exciting things are happening in your life these days?
Lots of stuff. So in general terms, I'm okay. I'm happy with the way things are going. Maybe the highlight of it all would be I just recently finished my DPhil, so doctoral studies. I defended my thesis mid-August, and then just recently I got the news that I got what people in Oxford call leave to supplicate. So I have officially finished the whole thing, and the results were outstanding. I wasn't expecting that. I got a pass, no corrections, and the thesis was recommended for publication. So yeah, absolutely thrilled.
Amazing. A fresh doctor in the midst here. We're very excited to have you. And to honestly, to hear your research. I mean, what a beautiful way to kind of share what you've been working on for the past couple of years with our audience. And so I'm going to go ahead and jump right in. What did you focus on? What is your research focus on? I would love to hear more about imagination and all the things that you focused on during your DPhil studies.
Ali, I've been obsessed with narratives, with stories, with mythology since I was a kid. And so it's not strange that I ended up talking about imagination, and not just the way it helps us to fantasize about worlds that don't exist, but actually trying to understand how it actually has an active role to play in the way we perceive and understand the world and our place in it. So that's the heart of it all. What I've done in my thesis could be summarized in two big lines of research. So on the one hand, trying to understand philosophically, what is the role, or how can we understand the role of imagination in belief formation and transformation? In other words, how does our imagination allow us to view the world in different ways? You know, if I ask you as a human being or as a student or as a professional or as a daughter or if you have a partner, like all of those are perspectives, windows through which we can understand or through which you see the world in different ways. And I'm sure if I ask you a few things today, and then we do another podcast in a few years, and I ask those same questions, your world views probably have changed. So the thesis tries to understand the role of imagination in those processes. How do we forge those worldviews, those narratives about ourselves and the world, right? And then the second line of research is, okay, looking at that and maybe having this idea that it might be a powerful tool, how could that tool be used to foster peace in places like Colombia. So applying that as a lens through which one looks at conflict and peace building in Colombia, where I'm from. So that's the thesis in a nutshell.
And can you tell us how you understand these roles of religious imagination playing a role in peacebuilding in Colombia, mm-hmm. especially over the past couple of years? I mean, you mentioned this already, obviously being from Colombia, and our listeners can go back and listen to Alejandro's episode where we talk about peacebuilding in Colombia. But what does peacebuilding have to do with religious imagination, and how maybe can you explain religious imagination before you answer the question too?
Sure. So if we understand imaginaries as those structures through which we understand the world, right? And that's the focus of the thesis. Religious imaginaries would be the structures, the mental frameworks, which are, you know, conceptual, but they're also affectively laden, through which religious people understand the world and themselves. So the way we see God, or the way we see a particular church, or the way we understand and experience our role within that church, the way our spiritual life sort of permeates the building up of our own identities as individuals or as part of a community, and how that is filled up and laden with our affects and emotions, and how that in itself has a counterpart in grounding our cultural practices. All of that, that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about religious imaginaries. So affectively laden thought patterns would be the way an author describes them. And so looking at those imaginaries, and you look at the case of Colombia, well, if you had a podcast with Alejo about it, you already know that religion is not a frontline, first line character in the history of Colombian conflict. I mean, this is not Ireland, this is not South Africa, this is not a clash between Catholics and Protestants, or between believers and non-believers. So that's one thing to take into account. However, it's really interesting to see how those imaginaries and references to religious language pop up everywhere throughout the political spectrum, both in the discourses of people that are for peace and against peace, and both on left and then the right side of the spectrum. So it's all over the place. If I had to summarize, you know, the role of religious imaginaries in peacebuilding in Colombia, I would say it's impossible to look at religious imaginaries without understanding the communities in which they are embedded, or the other around, the communities that are embedded within those imaginaries. And I would use the Truth Commission's report to sort of highlight three major roles that communities of faith have played. On the one hand, some of them have been victims. So priests, nuns, communities, believers, laymen, and women have been victims throughout the decades of war that we've had. There have also been contributions to war, sadly. So actively or by omission, there have been specific attitudes or imaginaries that have not contributed to peace, but to war. And then finally, there's been a lot of contributions to peace, and that's beautiful. So there's been prevention of youth recruitment, development of humanitarian missions, mediation in releasing kidnapped people, assistance to displaced populations, strengthening of the social fabric. There's been a ton of stuff through which all sorts of communities of faith, Christian and non-Christian, have been contributing. So that would be the role, I think.
Yeah, I would love to go back and maybe explain more of this religious imagination. I'm curious, I think the way that I've understood and heard others talk about maybe theology as a form of meaning making, can you differentiate how a person's individual theology is different from their religious imagination, and how you've been able to kind of decipher the two, and how people move through conflicts and peace building in the context that you're talking about in Colombia?
So the way I see it, at least, I would distinguish between, I mean, theology would be a rational effort to use revelation and spiritual experience to sort of develop a conceptual framework. That's the way I would understand theology in general, broadly speaking. If we're talking about personal theology, we would be trying to understand how a particular person understands their relationship with God and the transcendent, right? And how they develop a set of ideas. So I would say that theology is highly conceptual and even very rational, not rationalistic, but very rational. It's a theory, right? It's a discourse, it's a logos theology. When I talk about imaginaries, it does include theology in a sense, but it's much broader. Because once again, if we are discussing someone's ideas or someone's worldviews or someone's narratives, each of those words that I've used sort of highlights a particular aspect or angle, right? Philosophically speaking, when I phrase the discussion in terms of imaginaries, what I believe is fascinating and incredibly useful is the fact that you are not denying the conceptual side of it. It's not like you just put theology to the side or just dismiss concepts because you don't see they're useful. It's that just that you understand that those concepts and ideas are, again, effectively laid in. They have to do with the historical context of the person, their own experiences, where they come from. And it's not just, you know, what motivates a person to understand and acquiesce to a particular discourse. It's not just the fact that they believe it's true or false. It's also because they find meaning. It's because they are part of a community in which a particular idea makes sense. And so all of those are taken into account. And that's what I'm talking about when I talk about imaginaries. They do have a pole of tension that is strongly individual. So you could talk about a person's imaginaries, right? Or spiritual, religious imaginaries. But all of those also have a community pole of tension in the sense that you're always part of a circle. And in that sense, you're always in constant dialogue. You're always looking at what the group believes and feels and experiences, but also constantly, maybe unconsciously, trying to understand, okay, how do I appropriate and reappropriate these ideas? Does that make sense? Did I actually answer your question?
Yeah, a little bit. I think it's just language that prior to meeting you, I had never really heard about or heard discussed in divinity school or in other spaces. And so it almost, I mean, correct me if I'm, you know, reflecting this back to you incorrectly, but I see religious imaginaries as a form of using our faith to look into the future and imagine like a different world or like the next chapter of the world that we're living. Is that maybe something that like, is there like a kind of future framework that is used in religious imaginaries?
Yeah, it's partly prospective, but it's also about remembering and it's also about the present. I mean, I wouldn't limit the use of imaginaries in terms of projecting possible futures. That is one side of it, but I think the wonderful idea of these imaginaries is the reason why I believe they're so useful is because they are an interesting, useful way to characterize our experience of the world in general. And so that includes the way we look into the past and our memories, but it also has to do with our present time and the way we make decisions on the day-to-day basis. And it also has to do with the way we project ourselves onto the future. It's a concept that is philosophical by origin, but it's been discussed many times in social sciences. I agree with you. It's not a very common concept to use in theology or in religious studies, but I think one of the wonderful things about our time is interdisciplinary dialogues are happening more and more. And places like Oxford allow interesting platforms where you can have science and religion have a conversation, but you can also have social sciences come in and contribute to the whole thing. So yeah, part of what I've been trying to do is precisely that, trying to say, okay, maybe you can talk about parallel experiences between, you know, conflicts between between science and religion, say, and then the conflicts between different nations or group of people. And just as there's a philosophical way of approaching the conversation between science and religion and finding that they have common grounds and interesting shared resources, you can also look at these, you know, the big discussions in peace building and conflict transformation and say, well, maybe we have more in common than we suspect at the beginning. And in both cases, I believe imagination has a very important role to play.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I would love to talk about some of those kind of religious imaginations in practice. Can you share with us some successes of religious imagination in peace treaties, whether it's in Colombia or in other spaces? And then also as an expert, what are some areas that are still lacking the utilization of religious imagination?
As an expert? Wow. Okay. I'm flattered.
Yeah. I mean, you are. Oxford says you're a whole expert in this. So let's hear it.
So there's several things that I could say there. On the one hand, when you talk about peace building and conflict resolution, you know, peace treaties and peace agreements and peace accords are an important part of it. But I wouldn't limit it to that. So there's the whole negotiating, mediating, but there's also the preparing. And, you know, paving the road for that to happen, and then what comes after that. So, and I think in all of those stages, religious imaginaries have contributed strongly, at least in the case of Colombia. So when you talk about preparing the way for peace agreements, making sure that by the time those peace agreements are signed, the country, in a sense, is ready for it. I believe religious imaginaries have strongly contributed to strengthening those peaceable imaginaries and narratives within the country. So when we talk about peace, forgiveness, reconciliation, human dignity, all those sort of tropes that are common both in theology and in peace building. There's been many times in which churches, priests, and religious communities have helped with this. You know, a very clear example of that would be Pope Francis's visit to Colombia back in 2017. So we were amidst a very intense discussion around the peace agreements and whether or not they were going to be signed or not or ratified by the people. And the fact that Pope Francis came to Colombia and visited, you can look at his discourses, and they're all about peace, about the importance of finding ways to reconcile with one's brothers, about looking within ourselves and trying to acknowledge the fact that we've also committed mistakes, the harshness of war, the importance of looking at victims. And so it actually turned the tide. I mean, it was a very, very important visit to the country. So that's a very particular, specific, concrete example of how religious imaginaries sort of pave the way for these processes. Another example would be mediating. You know, religious people have been mediators in both in grassroots levels, but also in higher political stances. So, and that's not just in Colombia. I mean, think of Desmond Tutu's contribution in South Africa, right? In the case of Colombia, we have parish priests and communities all over the place working with people. And I've spoken to people from the government, from different institutions that are, you know, in the territory, getting their hands dirty with the peace building work. And everybody knows that whenever you go into those territories and visit, the first person you need to go to is the parish priest, because they know everyone and people tend to trust them. They're like nuclei of piece of information. So they're really important. But this also happens in higher political stances as well. So Father Francisco de Roo, who's a Jesuit, was the president of the Truth Commission here for many years. And both the nuncio and the bishops and archbishops have always been there willing to help. And both the Catholic Church and other Christian denominations have also been important there in mediating processes. And then you were asking about areas that we might be lacking. I would say I'm not entirely sure if I would phrase it in terms of something that we lack, but definitely a pending matter that we currently have would be fully implementing the peace accords that were signed, and then taking the Truth Commission's report and its recommendations seriously. There's a pending challenge there, which is, okay, we've signed the peace agreements. Violence has diminished considerably, so much so that there's been an open space for new negotiations to start and to initiate with other groups, right? And that's fascinating, and that's great. But then the question is, how do we make sure that once we cease to shoot each other, cultural transformation actually take place? How can we find those common values that are shared with non-religious folk as well? How can we build a more inclusive democracy together? And those are like huge, huge challenges. So I think that is a pending matter. And in a sense, that's the sort of space that I aim to contribute to.
Yeah, so I want to reflect back on what you've been saying to us so far. So there's this opportunity for religious imagination to be part of the conversation in spaces as tumultuous as peace-building accords, as has happened in Colombia, but you also gave examples of South Africa during the apartheid. And I think that there's, on this podcast through Healing Theology, there's always this kind of running thread of religion and public health. And kind of what the conversation we had with Alejandro as well is that peace building isn't inherently public health, but it also isn't not that either, because people's health thrives and does better when there's peace and not war. And so I want to take a moment to like specifically draw that line between religious imagination, peace building, peacekeeping, and public health. Can you give us some background around the conflict that enveloped Colombia for that many decades and the ways that people's health perhaps was harmed during that time and how it's changing to become better? I mean, you've already mentioned that the peace treaty being signed versus the peace treaty being actually implemented are two different things, and we're not totally there yet as a country. But can you tell us about how this religious imagination being a caveat or some sort of vehicle for actually getting these peace treaties moved forward, how they have impacted people's health in their immediate lives?
Sure. So we've had a conflict for decades now, and it has to do with politics, with power, with land, with the presence or absence of active of the government and the state in different places in the country. And after many, many years of having a major guerrilla group, the FARC back in the day, the peace accords were finally signed in 2016. And so that's basically the story. What has changed? Well, there's a lot of stuff happening. I mean, I think there's been a huge effort, both from the government and different governments we've had, but also, some more than others, but then civil society as well, to engage in peace-building efforts and initiatives, right? So a lot of people in the country have been trying to help out with, okay, how do we attend the victims? How can we talk with them and about them? How can we open spaces where they can talk, they're allowed their own voice? How can they be, how can human rights be defended? How can memory come up in novel and interesting and useful ways? And so all of that has happened since the peace agreements have been signed. I think the key aspect would be A, to strengthen the way public policy is structured and is aiming right now to strengthen peace building and conflict resolution everywhere in the country. And that includes both actual government, but also international cooperation, includes funding. It includes, that's one side of the coin. The other very big side of the coin is civil society. So even before the peace agreements were signed, there's been a lot, like tons, I mean, hundreds and thousands of efforts, groups of people, initiatives, religious and non-religious alike. I mean, talking about artists, human rights activists, social leaders, unionists, people that have been trying to strengthen the voice of peace in the country, or try to engage in civil disobedience or nonviolence. And so all of those groups, all of those initiatives contributed to sign the peace accord. They contributed to the Truth Commission's report as well. And so one of the key aspects that we need to engage with right now is, okay, how can we sort of bolster, strengthen those voices and ensure that they move on in this next stage that we're in right now? So I think all of that would be part of my answer. But yeah, I would stress and highlight the challenge of cultural transformation that I've spoken of before, but also understanding that we need all hands on deck. And in that sense, civil society has played an important role, and it does still have an important role to play. And again, within civil society, religious imaginaries are key and they're vital.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that goes back to something you mentioned earlier of, you know, how can we use the religious institutions of a local space, whether it's a, you know, whether it's the Catholic Church in Colombia or some other religious entity in a different context, how can they be vehicles or facilitators in actually creating a better society and creating peace and creating health? And, you know, we talk about this a lot on the podcast of like, there's oftentimes not legitimacy or power given to religious communities in the ways that they impact local people. Like, people are really driven and motivated by their faith leaders, by the Catholic Church, by whoever it is that they go, you know, seek their faith practices with. And I think it's time that both public health professionals, people like the UN, as we talked with Alejandro, local government or governmental officials, policymakers, that they start taking those partnerships seriously. Because it's almost like we're leaving progress and opportunity on the table because we're unwilling to engage with people's faith life and utilizing faith as a vehicle for change. Oh my gosh, there's so much opportunity here. And I want to save our last question because I think that there's a lot that we can learn within the US context on how I think the church has been kind of almost running into the fire per se and has been trying to help facilitate these conversations. Loving the conversation so far? Be sure to hit the subscribe button on your preferred podcast platform so you never miss an episode of Healing Theology. You can also check us out at healingtheology.com for deeper dives into our topics, to find our show notes, and to connect with other listeners. You can also leave us a review on whatever platform you're listening to, which helps us out a ton. Now, let's continue the discussion. In your doctoral studies, you focus on this topic of religious imagination and the roles of religion to help heal a nation. Can you give us some lessons that you've seen unfold in Colombia that other countries could learn from?
Definitely. No, I agree with what you were saying before. And I think I'll take up a few things that you said there, because when you talk about public health and the way you understand it, it's a huge, broad term. And I love it because it does sort of highlight the fact that the challenge has many faces, and there's a lot of stuff that we need to take into account. And in a sense, when you look at ecological discussions and environmental issues, it has a link with justice and social issues, and it also has a link with politics, and it also has a link with spiritual life and sort of the individual's experience. All of that has to be taken into account, and I believe that part of the benefits and the positive transformations that we've been going through is the fact that peace and the diminishing of war has started to open up a space for those things to happen, right? And in response to your question regarding sort of the lessons that we could learn from the case of Colombia, Scott Appleby at the University of Notre Dame has talked about the ambiguity of the sacred. It's his way of describing how religious imaginaries can sometimes cause divisions and support violence, but they can also strengthen peace, right, and motivate reconciliation. So he talks about the ambiguity of the sacred. I would honestly talk about the ambiguity of all things human. because you could say the same thing about politics, you could say the things about arts, you can say the same thing about science even. So in that sense, religious imaginaries and community of faith, I would say they're not enemies of democracy, of peace, of inclusion. And sometimes we do have that. There's a lot of talk about the post-secular turn, or that was a term that was being used a few years ago, just to say we had a moment when all things religious were an enemy of the public and you could not talk about God and religion. And then there was this sort of post-secular turn in which suddenly democracies realized that, okay, you could open up a space for religions to engage with because they can be allies. And so I think that part of it is still, it still applies today. It definitely applies in the case of Colombia. And so I would say religious communities and religious imaginaries, they are linked with groups of people that are part of civil society. And so they also require attention. They also need safe platforms where they can coincide with others and eventually visualize, form, and transform their own imaginaries. So that's one side of it all. And I think that's been present in the case of Colombia. And you could learn from that experience. And then finally, taking up the Truth Commission's report once again, they are important allies for peace building and for cultural transformation. The Truth Commission's report talks about devices of cultural readdition, key points that have played a role and can play a role in the way culture shifts in the country. So it includes education, it includes the media, it includes government narratives. But it is interesting to note how the Truth Commission's report also includes communities of faith there. And so understanding those two sides of the coin, right? Communities of faith and their religious imaginaries are part of civil society. So they play a role in cultural transformation. They also need attention. They also need to look within and revise their own imaginaries. But on the other hand, they do have a significant role to play as devices of cultural readdition. So looking at communities of faith as allies or potential allies and trying to understand how there are ways in which we can strengthen that is maybe one of the key lessons that I think we need to learn.
It's making me think about, as you were mentioning, kind of the turn towards secularization. For good reason, I think there's been like a villainization or like making a villain of the church. Again, mm-hmm. for good reason. By no means is this podcast defending all of the things that the church has done wrong, because there's a long list of it. And however, I think what I've seen in public health, and it sounds like it's happening in your field of studies as well, and I think it happens wherever religion is involved, is that this villainization turns it into like, let's just put it in the gutter. Let's just like ignore it. And we don't have to deal with it because of religious freedom, separation of church and state, whatever language you want to use around like justifying not interacting or collaborating with religious communities. Which what I would say to that is that if there was an ethnic minority, if there was a racial minority, if there was some sort of minority that was a fifth of the population or a sixth, you know, a tenth of the population, and we said, oh, that tenth doesn't matter, no scientist, no researcher, no scholar would be like, oh yeah, we can just like delete that 10%. Like, I think we need to recognize that. I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I don't think we're saying like religion needs to be at the forefront, needs to be the umbrella that we all get under to like create some sort of unity or to create peace. But we are, what I would say is that I don't think we need to make everybody have these same religious ideologies, but we need to incorporate those people that do see themselves or are heavily motivated by their religion. How do we incorporate that 10% or whatever percentage of whatever population we're talking about? How do we incorporate them in the solutions, in the conversations, and not kind of ostracize them because of their belief? Mm-hmm. It's just like any other social identity. And so why would we ever ignore a social identity and ignore partnerships and potential collaboration opportunities with any group of people, regardless mm-hmm. of their belief or whatever? I'm mm-hmm. curious about what you have to say to that.
No, I think I agree with most of what you've said. I think you describe that as villainization, right? And so when you ostracize, when you villainize, when you polarize a discussion and sort of absolutize, is that a word? You read a person absolutely and exclusively from a specific angle and from a lens. So he is a bad guy. She is a guerrilla member. So she is an enemy. They're the others. When you other, this sort of othering, what you're doing there is eventually you're reducing the other to the way you relate to them, and you tend to forget that they're human beings.
Yeah.
And so there's a difference between the human being that you're talking to when you're talking with and their imaginaries again. And so, yes, I would say the different churches have done wrong, and sometimes they still do, sadly. Again, they've also been victims. Again, they've also contributed to peace. And so if you try to look at the entire spectrum, both in terms of the roles that these groups have had, A. And B, if you look at people and try to broaden that spectrum as well, you can say, okay, I'm not just talking to my enemy. I'm not just talking to the other. I'm talking to a human being. They have their own story, their own context. They have their reasons why they believe whatever it is that they believe. It's not that you have to agree, but once you sort of complexify, broaden, and enrich the perspective, dialogue is possible. The beauty of dialogue is the fact that you enable platforms where you can coincide with others and sort of clash with them, but in nonviolent ways. I think that's the key aspect of it all. I mean, if you engage with communities of faith in that way, it not only will help the communities of faith, but it'll also help you. And that's exactly the approach I would have with people who I don't agree with politically or economically, or people that are different, right, in whichever way they are. It might sound obvious, or it might even sound naive or like a common idea, but I think it's key. I mean, if you look at the other, not just from the lens of whatever it is you're seeing in them, in terms of them being friends or enemies, but you look at them as human beings, the whole discussion changes.
I have a quickly held or a strongly held belief around liberation, because I think a lot of our work centers around liberation. And it's that we will not actually get to liberation by othering others. This like scapegoating of like, let's take out one group and put in another group as the punching bag, like that will never actually lead us to our desired goal of liberation. And I think, again, I'm not defending the church. I'm not defending religious groups. They have messed up a lot, and we need to call them into conversation during that. And also, like, they cannot be the thing that we ostracize as a form of reparation to all the harm that they've done in the past. And so I appreciate you being able to call us out of that binary thinking of like something is good and something is bad and there's no in between and there's no way to like kind of salvage pieces. And we have, I think we're trying to avoid throwing the baby out with the bathwater because that doesn't really help. So there's a paper that you recently wrote, which I will happily link in the show notes for our readers to review. But you write this quote that I want to ask you about. So you say that overcoming social violence does not aim towards the absence of conflict and difference, but it does aim towards the absence of violence, approaching divergence of thought and differences as opportunities for dialogue and mutual enrichment. I feel like we were just talking about that a little bit. It helps paint how peace building is kind of this antidote for violence and not conflict, as we've been talking about. And there's so many times when you were talking where I was like, wow, look at the Catholic Church kind of running into the conflict in Colombia. And in my head, I was like, wow, I wish the church in the U.S. would run towards conflicts instead of away from conflicts. And I'm thinking about like the way that the church in the U.S. has kind of been bearing its complacency in the horrors of the past and the present. So I'm thinking of things like racism and slavery and homophobia and Christian nationalism, white supremacy. There's so many opportunities here in a U.S. context where the church has had either active or passive roles in helping kind of root these evils into public narrative. And I don't see the church running into the fire, if we're keeping with that analogy. I don't see them running into the fire as the Catholic Church has been doing in Colombia here in the U.S. with these topics. And so I'm wondering, what lessons do we stand to learn in the U.S. about peace building and running towards the conflict as peace builders rooted in our faith instead of running away from it? Mm-hmm. And I know that the U.S. is maybe not a context that you work in as much, but I'm just wondering, as an outsider, like, what do you think we can stand to learn?
Yeah. So if we're talking about the church, I would say there's a huge effort in terms of synodality, which I think is very, very powerful and interesting. And it's happening throughout the entire Catholic Church. So
what's synodality? I've never heard of it.
Yeah. So, okay. It's a Greek word. So syn means with. And hodos means a road. So a synod, technically speaking, is a crossroads. It's a place. It talks about walking alongside others, walking with others, or, crossing my path with yours. So in a sense, so that's the etymological description of the word. Theologically, a synod is officially a kind of meeting, right? Usually between bishops, to make decisions in terms of and reflect and pray for the church. So it's kind of like a mini council, if you will, something like that. What I'm saying is there's been big efforts coming from Pope Francis, from Rome, and from the rest of the Catholic Church to highlight the fact that if you look deeply into what synodality means, the sort of attitude of walking with, it does open an interesting space for others within the church. And by others, I mean non-Roman folk, I mean laymen and women, I mean non-bishops, I mean society, civil society, to actively contribute to the way we reflect, pray, and make decisions within the church. So it's a huge effort. And it's, although it has a lot of theological and political connotations, I would say that when it comes to peace building, it's a very powerful example of how you can, there is a way in which religious imaginaries can sort of substantiate and ground nonviolent approaches, right? Mm-hmm. And sort of bolster these sort of platforms where decision-making and healthy confrontation can take place. And in general terms, I would say transforming our own imaginaries, that's always tough, especially if they're grounding imaginaries, right? If I question you about ideas that you don't hold dear, you might be willing to engage in a conversation and that might not shake you much. But if I touch on grounding imaginaries that you hold dear, that are part of, you know, important, essential aspects of the way you see the world or you see yourself, that's always going to be difficult. And sometimes when you talk about peace building and conflict resolution, that's the kind of shift that you need. And so I would say that there's, in terms of attitude, at least, it's important to cultivate both realism, but also hope. Realism in the sense of it's important to address these difficulties. And so when you say the church in the US is shunning or is avoiding conflict, I would say, well, how about we talk plainly and straightforwardly about these things? How about we open up spaces where those conversations can be had? So realism in the sense of addressing these difficulties and engaging with them. Realism also in the sense of humility. St. Therese talks about humility as walking in truth. And so if realism has a link with truth, then it also has a link with humility. So paying attention to victims, acknowledging the fact that we have made mistakes. And by we, I mean the church and everybody, right? And then on the other hand, alongside that realism, I think another very important attitude is hope. Sort of understanding, and not just a naive sort of optimism, but actually understanding that in the rigorous and serious approach to reality, in that reality itself, alongside those shadows, there is also sufficient reason to be curious and to explore the possibility of adapting and enhancing, of improving. So all of that, I think, is essential part of the attitudes that we need. And then finally, alongside those attitudes, I think we need to find the means to explore, to be curious of our own resources and find that theology, spiritual experience, it does call us into action. It does question violence. It does question our ignoring how people suffer. It does question the way we easily polarize and other and unnecessarily victimize, or all of those things that we've been talking about. And so that's what I would say in that line.
That's amazing. And I think as you've shared with us already, there's so many, I think, practical tools that can be implemented as we have these conversations. And I think I've mentioned this at the end of probably every podcast so far, and it probably will be a theme for the second season. But here in the US, we're in the midst of a major election, which has a lot of polarization, a lot of binary thinking, a lot of we're the good guys and they're the bad guys. And I think whether we're talking about religious imagination or we're just talking about how to be human, which I think is a kind of a foundational aspect of the research that you do, is like, how do we stop hurting each other? And how do we imagine kind of a better world in a practical sense, in a sense that is rooted in the mysticism of being human? And I just hope that our listeners can take this into consideration. And, you know, all the things that we talked about are in the context of Colombia and peace building, a lot of the things that we touched on here, but we stand to learn a lot as we have discussions with our neighbors here around our election. Do you have any other closing thoughts?
Yeah, well, I just remember that regarding that specific point on the elections. So there's an author very well known in peace building. He's called John Paul Lederach. So he's an emeritus professor at the Kroc Institute at the University of Notre Dame. And he's been involved in many, many peace building initiatives all around the world, including Colombia. And so maybe one of his famous books is called The Moral Imagination. And it's one of the reasons why I ended up talking about imagination in the first place, because it's through Lederach that I realized that imagination as a category had, you know, broad and very rich possibilities for a number of things. And so I'm bringing him up because he's American. He is in the US and he's recently published something on that regard, sort of a set of reflections precisely because of elections and how there's a link between polarization and violence. So polarization by itself, it might not necessarily be a bad thing, in as much as you can perfectly well say you are thinking something that is entirely different to the way I think, and I completely disagree with it. And in a sense, so you're acknowledging that there is, that you have two poles. And so I think in itself, it's not necessarily wrong. But when you reduce the discussion to those two things and you don't understand that even those ideas that you don't agree with, again, They come from a context. They have a reason and they have meaning to the people that are talking to you. And it's engaging with those stories that you start finding, well, maybe we do have common grounds. Maybe there are other ways around the argument. Maybe there are different ways in which we can engage. Maybe violence is not necessarily the right way to go. That also helps. So I'm going to look it up because I don't have the name of the text right here, but it's open access. I mean, everybody can have a look at it. And Lederach is just all around an amazing guy and a great peace building theoretician and practitioner. So I would recommend that in the case for our American audience, at least.
Yeah, I will link it in the show notes and people can check it out if they so please, or share it with whoever they want. So we have this tradition here on the podcast where I end the podcast with a Furious Five. So it's questions that start maybe a little bit intensely and kind of deep, but turn into just us asking some fun questions to end the show. So are you ready for our Furious Five?
Oh, good God. Okay.
It'll be fine. Don't think about it too hard. If you could instantly solve one challenge related to the intersection of public health and religion, what would it be and how would you religiously imagine the solution?
That's interesting. I think a key aspect of it all would be highlighting this idea of religious imaginaries. And I don't want to talk about it all the time, but it's so bluntly obvious to me that our approach to the world and our approach to our spiritual life and even theology is mediated by our imaginaries. And so long as we don't visualize those imaginaries, sometimes we sort of naively, I think that our ideas are rigid, are necessary. This is the only way to look at the world. This is the only way to interpret scripture. This is the only way to solve the country. This is the only way to vote the right way. This is the only way to be a Christian. And well, the minute you visualize and you understand that your approach to the world is mediated to imaginaries, and you see how those imaginaries have a story behind them, you immediately start to broaden the perspective and enrich the possibilities and allow yourself to be curious and even question your own ideas about the world. And so I think in that intersection of public health and religion, if you avoid that sort of rigid approach to your ideas and you understand that there are imaginaries at play, well, you realize, well, if I keep my rigid approach to these ideas, what I'm doing is crystallizing them and I'm turning them into fossils. And that's not the way to go. You need them to breathe. You need them to be organic, living beings. And as long as you do that, the discussion between religion and public health will be completely different and much better and enriched.
This question might kind of bleed into the answer you just gave us, but that's okay. What do you believe is the most significant obstacle we need to overcome in the near future to improve this relationship of religion and public health?
Yeah, so in a sense, I've already said something about that, but I would add to that the fact that, at least in the case of Colombia, it's not just looking at the way religious imaginaries have fostered violence and war in the country, or sometimes they have, but also how it's also introduced chasms and fractures and divisions within the communities of faith in themselves. And so I think a major obstacle would be a way to sort of, I'll rephrase that. Maybe one of the biggest obstacles is the fact that we haven't acknowledged those differences and those fractures and those divisions. And so we need to acknowledge, okay, there are tensions between the Catholic Church and the other denominations. There are tensions within the church between people that are for and against the peace agreements. There are divisions between people. And so all of those divisions, all of those conflicts, in a sense, need to be acknowledged. And as if we don't acknowledge them, and if we don't understand that those differences are there, and if we don't try to engage with them in nonviolent ways, it's almost like shooting one's foot. It's almost like you're trying to heal others without being fully aware that you need healing yourself. Mm-hmm. And so that would be a big obstacle that I think we need to overcome.
On the topic of religion and health, do you have any recommendations for our listeners, whether it's a book or a podcast or a show that you want to share?
So in addition to the book that I just mentioned by Lederach, so there is a podcast on Being by Krista Tippett, and it's a very famous podcast, and it's not just about religion and health, but I would say if someone is interested in that, there are numerous episodes in which she engages with peace builders. There's one or two that she actually interviews Lederach, I just remembered. Mm. And so what I like about that podcast is it's broad ranging. It's a very human conversation. So when people go to the podcast, they're not just talking about the specific topic that they're engaging mm-hmm. with, but they talk about their life, their spiritual convictions, they talk about their day to day. So I think it's a really good one.
Speaking of the human and the like lived experience, where are you finding joy and hope these days?
Joy and hope. Nature, literature, my family, my partner. I love him very much. Looking at my life and fostering a sense of gratitude. I think that also, and I mean in terms of sitting down and writing a bit or just journaling or having a few minutes to meditate or to breathe or to exercise and look back into my life and say, okay, I have a number of things that I need to work on and I need problems that I need to solve. But there have been so many good things happening and so many blessings and privileges that, you know, understanding that there are, again, lights and shadows, but acknowledging the light immediately connects me with a sense of gratitude. And that brings a lot of joy and hope.
I love that. And lastly, where can people connect with you?
Where can people connect? Well, I mean, I have my LinkedIn website. There's also the, so within the university, there's a website with all of my details and the topic that I've been working on. I have a Twitter account as well, but an X account. Yeah. So I can give you all of those if you want me to.
Great. We'll have that all linked in your bio in the website. Well, Dr. Gutierrez, Eduardo, it was so wonderful to have this conversation and just for your ability to help us imagine and utilize kind of our humanness in this conversation of peace building and just being better to one another, which is something that the world needs desperately. And congratulations again on finishing your PhD. We're honored to get to hear bits of it through this podcast.
Thank you, Ali. I'm thrilled. I was very, very happy to be here. And yeah, I mean, I think, again, peace is a very worthwhile endeavor and a worthwhile ideal to have. And it requires all hands on deck. So if anything that I've done throughout my research, if anything that I've done through the classes I've taught and the conversations that we've had, if it sparks hope, if it allows people to be thrilled and mesmerized by the idea of peace building, if it questions our ideas about oneself, if it sort of sparks curiosity about our imagination and the way we see the world, you know, the what ifs, what if the world can be looked at in a different way? What if this person is not just exclusively what I've been seeing from this person so far? What if there are other ways to envision our place in the world? I'll be more than happy. Yeah. Happy to serve.
Well, you're doing great. So thank you for helping us imagine.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Healing Theology podcast. We hope today's episode brought you new insights and inspired you to think differently about the intersection of religion and public health. If you enjoyed the show, please consider leaving us a rating or a review, as it really helps others find this podcast. And remember to subscribe so that you never miss a future episode. For more information, resources, and today's show notes, and also to connect with us, please visit us at healingtheology.com. Until next time, stay curious, stay compassionate, and keep the conversation going.